film Inception appealed to our curiosity to understand the mysteries of dreams. It was outlandish, and the science, well, it was fiction. But that begs the question, what do scientists know about dreams, and what do psychologists have to say about dream interpretation? I'm Bill Anderson. This is Central Standard. We'll talk about efforts to code dreams and Sigmund Freud's role in dream analysis studies. But first, are you one of the millions of people who struggle with sleep? We'll talk about the consequences of those restless nights and learn about creative ways you might find sleep nirvana. Sleep, dreams, memory, and emotion, and the relationship between them. Later in the hour, your memories of the explosion at JJ's restaurant. But first, the news from NPR. When you awaken from a dream, maybe a nightmare, do you try to interpret it? Or do you dismiss it as the side effects of anxiety or a too spicy dinner? I'm Bill Anderson. Welcome to Central Standard. Today we look at the science behind dreams, attempts to code them, the relevance of dreams in religion and world civilizations. We look at some common dreams and offer some possible interpretations. But before we can dream, we have to get to sleep, right? So let's first talk about sleep, a key factor in mental and physical health. Maybe you're like me. You struggle through periods of insomnia. If so, perhaps we can provide you with some sleep-inducing techniques or strategies. Our sleep experts this morning, Dr. Scott Eveloff, a sleep physician at the American Sleep Medicine. He joins us by phone. And good morning, doctor.
Hi there.
Nice to have you with us.
Thanks for having me.
Dr. Damian Stevens is director of the Sleep Disorder Center at KU Medical Center. Good morning.
Good morning.
And let's start with you, Dr. Stevens. Of all the things we can do to stay healthy, a restful night of sleep has to be up near the top.
Yes, it's definitely one of the more important things that the human body undergoes to maintain overall health, alertness, just in general.
And there are, Dr. Eveloff, there are four stages of sleep, right? Could you give us a quick primer on each?
Sure. First, sleep is divided basically into non-REM and REM, REM meaning rapid eye movement, which is dream sleep. We spend about a fourth of our night in REM or dream sleep, and the remainder of the night in non-REM sleep, and then non-REM sleep is divided up into stages 1, 2, 3, and 4. The higher the number, the deeper the stage of sleep, basically. So that's just a real brief schematic of what goes on during the night, and each of these stages occurs cyclically throughout the night.
Like how many times?
Oh, anywhere from 3 to 4 times. Each cycle lasts maybe about 90 minutes. So again, maybe 3 or 4 cycles throughout the night in your average normal sleeping person.
And doctor, is each one reliant on the other? Are they all equally important, I guess, is my question?
Well, no. They each have different mechanisms and different functions. You do have to progress through each one to get to the next one, although in a sleep study, for example, we don't always see that. But typically, yes, each cycle is supposed to be a set progression through each stage of sleep, the last one ending in dream sleep, mm-hmm. and then, in theory, it starts over again.
Dr. Stevens, anything to add?
No, that's very accurate. There are some differences of these stages as we age. You know, interestingly, when you're a child, you have a newborn especially has sometimes even up to 30-40% REM sleep. As we age, some of these stages do change also. As we get older in our 60s and 70s, the stage 3 and 4 can decrease significantly. REM can vary also. We have a lot of the, quote, lighter sleep, stage N1, N2, as opposed to the younger people. And that's one of the big differences also as we age.
So as we look at sleep disorders, what are some of the more common ones? Insomnia is probably at the top of the list, or maybe sleep apnea is?
Both insomnia and sleep apnea make up the vast majority of reasons that patients come to see a physician, a sleep specialist typically. You know, with insomnia, typically difficulty falling asleep and or staying asleep. Quite often patients have already done a lot of internet research, investigated different things, home remedies, talked to friends, talked to family, have maybe tried a few things, but just not having any success. Obstructive sleep apnea presents with loud snoring, witness apneas, daytime sleepiness, interrupted sleep. And I would say that's probably 60-70% of the patients we see is some one of those two diagnoses.
What about narcolepsy?
Narcolepsy is definitely something we see in the clinic. It's just not as common.
Okay.
Narcolepsy quite often will be missed for several years. There's been lots of studies looking at this, and it quite often is a sad scenario where a kid has done poorly in school for several years, did fairly well through grade school, junior high, and grades started falling, and the teacher starts mentioning the child looks sleepy, is falling asleep in class, grades are suffering, and they think they're disinterested. The child, adolescent, sometimes gets blamed for this disinterested scenario, and in reality, it's a sleep disorder that a lot of times a parent even feels guilty about because they never thought about it.
In preparing for this show, I came across a condition called parasomnia.
Parasomnia is, as it sounds, para is, quote, next to or adjacent to, and somnias are the old Greek Roman term for sleep. So what a parasomnia is, it's someone that is doing things. Now, there's all kinds of different things. Acting out dreams is one form of a parasomnia, but sleepwalking, sleep talking, night terrors, mm-hmm. all these are, quote, parasomnias.
Okay.
And that they're doing things when they're typically asleep. And if you ask a bed partner or you ask a family member, they look like they're asleep for all the world, but the patient's doing these activities that you don't typically see during sleep.
Dr. Scott Eveloff, looking at insomnia, can you give us a sense for what the brain activity looks like during a bout of insomnia versus a healthy sleeping person?
Well, first of all, let me just amplify on something Dr. Stevens said, is that, yeah, insomnia and sleep apnea are very common. And the thing is, many times they coexist. So one actually interacts with the other. Insomnia, as Dr. Stevens referred to, is an inability to fall asleep when given the chance, either initially or you wake up and can't get back to sleep. And during these times, if you're in a sleep lab, your brain wave will show waking brain waves, which are fairly rapid. And, you know, as we progress through sleep, our brain waves start to slow down. So, you know, one of the hallmarks we see in a sleep study is no matter what the patient looks like, if their brain wave is generating rapid, they're called alpha waves, which is relaxed wakefulness, they're awake. And then when those alpha waves slow down, that's when they start drifting into sleep. So, again, what we like to see and what the normal person should do is eventually gradually slow down the brain wave activity as they progress from wakefulness to sleep.
And all of the brain activity while we're sleeping can be affected by sources, culprits like nerves, perhaps even pain.
It can be affected by so many things, and there's often a reciprocal relationship. Sleep can interact on and impact pain, anxiety, etc., but certainly pain, anxiety, medications, which are very common, can all affect sleep. And that's what makes treatment of some sleep disorders very difficult, because they're rarely, I think, is just one specific thing, especially when it comes to insomnia. You have to take into account what the patient's going through lifestyle-wise, worries about work, etc., pain, physical disorders, asthma, heart disease, and then medication. So it's rarely just one specific thing. It's a constellation of things that can impact on sleep that you always have to be aware of.
That's Dr. Scott Eveloff, a sleep physician at American Sleep Medicine in Leawood. Also in the studio, Dr. Damian Stevens, director of the Sleep Disorder Center at KU Medical Center. This is Central Standard. I'm Bill Anderson. We're looking at sleep and the disorders that keep many of us awake at night. What keeps you up? 816-235-2888. Drop in via email, centralstandard@kcur.org. By the way, in the second half of today's show, the psychology and physiology of dreams, plus our social media producer joins us to talk about last year's explosion at JJ's. So, Dr. Stevens, let's talk about it. I walk into the clinic. And I tell you that I'm having bouts of insomnia. It's not constant, but it's kind of periodic. Where do we go from there? What happens?
We always start with a good history, and by and large, in the field of sleep medicine, you can quite often already come up with your plan just by interviewing, talking to the patient. And it's a pretty detailed conversation. You know, when did it start? Did it coincide with other events? You know, a financial, a family, a health issue. I slept well until, you know, I got fired. Now I'm unemployed. So there's just countless different things, just like Dr. Eveloff referred to, that relate to sleep, sleep quality, insomnia. So once you've gone through that detailed of any current stressors, also just how long has this been? I did this 10 years ago, it got better, or that I've been fighting this for 30 years. When you hear this lifelong or multiple decades of bad insomnia, you typically can already counsel the patient. This is probably not going to disappear. This is something you're going to be, you know, dealing with on a long-term basis, and that quite often will decide your approach to treating the patient may be different options as opposed to someone who has a short-term issue.
So how are you going about studying me? You're poking, you're probing, you know, you're asking me questions, as you alluded to.
Quite often, if it's insomnia as the main symptom, there's not a lot of other testing. Even the examination, there's not a lot of specific things we look for, you know, in the heart, the lungs, or anything like that. It's more of a asking you questions as far as what's going on. Like Dr. Eveloff already mentioned, also medications definitely can contribute to insomnia.
Give me a couple of examples of medicines.
Some medicines for blood pressure can actually trigger insomnia. Patients requiring steroids for certain health problems, it's one of the more common medications that quite often cause pretty severe insomnia with steroids. That's the main ones we typically or that's some of the ones that we typically deal with, although you can see some people this very sensitive. Some of the antibiotics even patients will use can worsen or trigger insomnia too.
And I know that that caffeine will stay in the body for mm-hmm. what, some 8 hours?
That can be a big issue in some patients also, although I think many have in the modern day have used so much caffeine because there's definitely some degree of tolerance of caffeine. When we didn't drink as much, you know, 20, 30 years ago, some degree of caffeine probably had a bigger effect. Now we seem to have so many people drinking so much, it may not be as important than some. But that gets into what we call about a sleep hygiene history also.
Okay. And Dr. Eveloff, you know, in this modern era, we've got this technology revolution going on, and there's the issue of the overstimulation we might get from computers or even televisions. Can you talk about that?
Absolutely. That's, as you just mentioned, becoming increasingly important, and as you know, that's one of the things, you know, along with what Dr. Stevens mentioned regarding, you know, general lifestyle factors. You know, using an electronic device in the evening or at night, sort of a double whammy. Not only does it tend to stimulate the brain or activate the brain, which is exactly the wrong thing you want to do before sleep, but the light input itself can also have a detrimental effect on when the brain feels ready to go to sleep. So whether it's television, whether it's iPads, whether it's computers, in this day and age, most people probably save their internet scanning for when they have nothing else to do, like, for example, when they're getting ready to go to sleep. And again, they're introducing light into their brain and they're introducing activation into their brain, and both of those are going to work against easily obtaining sleep.
But man, do I get a jump start on my work day.
Just to add to what Dr. Eveloff mentioned, this texting in the adolescent population, there's been several studies now looking at this. You know, the 16-year-old takes their cell phone to bed, and you know, when you look at the phone the next morning, you find out they were texting at 11 a.m. or 11 p.m., mm-hmm. midnight, even past that time, even texting through the middle of the night, and it just adds to that sleep deprivation typically also.
Never mind the fact that many teenagers already have a physiologic predisposition towards a delayed bedtime, a delayed sleep time, so they're already up against it, and then, as you say, they add in the texting, the light, the computers, and it just often makes a very bad situation worse.
Well, what should I do? I'm told I'm not supposed to lay there and toss and turn, that I need to get up out of bed because because it's just not healthy to do otherwise, and it's not going to help the situation. What activity should I engage in once I do get up?
Well, what I tell people is, I mean, you're absolutely right. The longer you stay in bed awake, the longer you will be in bed awake. You're conditioning your brain into associating wakefulness with the bed instead of sleep and peace with the bed. So, yeah, we usually, the teaching is someone should get out of bed after they have not been able to achieve sleep. And what I tell them to do is distract, don't activate. And by that I mean go into a room you commonly are awake in, the kitchen, the living room, etc. If you want to read something non-activating, if you want to do crossword puzzles, just, again, something that won't allow you just to sit there and stare in the dark, but also not work on your taxes or work on work. It's distract, but don't activate, and then return to your bed when you feel sleepy.
Dr. Stevens, would it help if I warmed up some milk?
That may be a benefit if it's something that the patient finds it's beneficial, it's relaxing to them, then absolutely, by all means, I would say that would be something useful. As far as research specifically looking at that intervention, I can't say there's a lot of literature out there to say that. But any of those kind of low-key activities that allows the patient to kind of, quote, shut their brain down, slow down, would be beneficial.
What about eating before bed? I'm going to assume, because oftentimes it has sugar in it. I know my cereal that I eat before bedtime does. So talk a little bit about that, Dr. Stevens.
We really like to avoid that for several reasons. You know, if nothing else, it's just one additional calorie load right before the bedtime. So
yeah,
we'd like to avoid it for that reason alone. You know, some patients will wake up related to indigestion even after sleeping a couple hours. So there's another reason. If there's, you know, caffeine involved, some patients, you know, kind of like the warm milk thing, do find that's beneficial. So if it's a very small amount and they think it helps them sleep, I wouldn't necessarily dissuade them, but I would counsel that as avoiding something to avoid if they're already complaining of insomnia and using that to try to help them sleep. There are quite a few patients that will get up in the middle of the night and sleep also. We've seen that with some of our sleeping pills. And there's some patients that just do that on their own, will get up and have this kind of half awake, half asleep in the middle of the night. That is another sleep disorder we sometimes see.
Well, let's talk a little bit about medicine. Is that used as kind of a last ditch effort to get it under control, or how do you go about prescribing that? And we'll start with you, Dr. Stevens.
It's kind of like I referred to earlier. Every patient you approach with a kind of, you know, catered towards that patient. A patient that's already been on medications for 10 to 20 years, it's now seen me, it's very unlikely they're going to be able to function without some form of sleeping pill or medication to help them sleep. If it's that scenario, then quite often I will send that individual to a psychologist for what we call cognitive behavioral therapy. And it's briefly what Dr. Eveloff referred to. It's teaching that patient to relearn that association between being in bed and being asleep. And the cognitive behavioral therapist is quite often very beneficial in that setting. So yes, they may still need a pill, but quite often by the time they've seen us, they're on the pill, they're still not sleeping. We do some of these other interventions. Sometimes it's a simple sleep hygiene. You know, quite often the patient will never have thought of the fact that they're drinking, you know, two cups of coffee, getting to bed 2 hours later, or they're exercising and, you know, taking a shower and jumping into bed within 30 minutes, which sometimes can make insomnia. So there's a lot of these behavioral things or hygiene issues that we also can address, and some patients that will actually do better just with that alone.
Dr. Eveloff, anything to add?
Well, I think the use of sleep medicine in general is philosophical. You'll find a lot of literature and a lot of doctors who sway more towards the behavioral aspects. I think many primary care physicians are extremely leery of using sleep medicines for the danger of it being a habit-forming type of process. You know, I think that, like Dr. Stevens said, every patient has to be individualized, but I wouldn't be dogmatic and say, no, sleeping pills shouldn't be used, or sleeping pills should be used in every patient. I think there is a role for sleeping medications, but it has to be coupled with everything we've both just been talking about. You explore all the things that could be interacting, all the, you know, behaviors, etc., And then if necessary, and if done very responsibly and judiciously, I think that there is a role for use of sleeping medicine as well in some patients.
Speaking of dogma, I see that dogs sleep an average of 10 hours a day. Cats about 13 for the record, and just to be fair. Hey, I use valerian root, and it may be psychological, but I find some satisfaction sleep-wise in using that product. And I have friends that swear by melatonin.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we've got an email from one of our listeners asking, can you suggest a safe, non-addictive sleeping pill for really anxious, sleepless nights?
Well, first, when it comes to the use of valerian root, out of all the herbal remedies I've heard of, there may actually be some scientific basis behind valerian root. It actually does contain one of the naturally occurring sleep neurotransmitters. So, again, out of all the herbal remedies, valerian root could be possibly used, again, with the proper amount of care.
Mm-hmm.
I think everyone is looking for some, quote-unquote, non-addictive sleep aid. You know, first, I don't think it's a matter of addiction. People can become it can become physically dependent on these medications, which, in my opinion, is different from addiction. But regardless, people look to melatonin, and melatonin is typically not a sleeping pill. It can adjust your internal clock, and in some people, it can induce sleep. But people tend to misuse it. They use it right before bed. They use it in much higher doses. So if you want to start off with herbal remedies, be it just non-caffeinated tea to help relax versus valerian root versus melatonin, if used properly within the right context, those are okay. The nice thing is modern pharmacology has come up with many prescription medications that don't have the habit form of potential of the older ones. So really, these days, there's a whole range of both prescription and over-the-counter medicines that are not technically habit-forming, and that can be used.
Yes, I agree with Dr. Eveloff also. You know, compared to decades ago, whenever a patient would come to the physician and say, I need a sleeping pill, they were given a benzodiazepine or even barbiturates, which would be very habit-forming. They would be on for years and quite often have difficulty trying to stop them down the road. We just see that as far less of an issue with our newer medications. Now, that being said, yes, there are still quite a few patients. If you're on this medicine for a long time and then you try to sleep without it, you will not sleep as well. But that gets into your definition of, quote, addiction, because quite mm-hmm. often you can still wean that patient off, taper them slowly over time, go from taking it nightly to taking it on an as-needed basis if there's a couple nights a week that they feel more stressed. So overall, we have a lot more options than we had treating insomnia compared to 20, 30 years ago.
And we talked about this before we hit the airwaves. You mentioned performance anxiety. A person mm-hmm. has two nights of rough sleep, goes to bed the third night, and it's that dead tired, mm-hmm. but it's that performance anxiety that's yeah. going to keep that person away. Talk a little bit about that.
Well, that was the individual that trained me in insomnia treatment. That's kind of the way to sometimes think of it in some patients. You know, if individuals used to, being successful their entire life, they practice at different things. And as human beings, that's what we typically see. The more we practice at something, the better we are. Well, sleep is one of those things you can't necessarily, quote, practice for. It's something that has to come naturally, or we, do something to assist it. But patients will develop anxiety about not being able to sleep, and it almost becomes a downward spiral, because if you have a couple bad nights of sleep, and by the time they get to that third or fourth night, they actually will start even panicking about not sleeping at dinner time. It's mm-hmm. 7 o'clock, and they're thinking, oh, I'm going to be in bed in 3 or 4 hours, and I'm going to lay there, stare at the ceiling, I'm going to get out of bed, and they've already kind of pre-planned their night of bad sleep. So in a way, it is a, quote, performance anxiety.
Is it possible to catch up on missed sleep, Dr. Eveloff?
Yes, it is. You can actually build up a sleep debt, and you can make deposits back into that debt, but it doesn't happen as quickly as most people think. But if over the course of time, every night you're sleep deprived, yes, you will build up a debt, but if given enough time, typically, unfortunately, not even over a weekend, you can regain that as well.
Okay. I read somewhere, and of course it was on the internet, so I have no idea if this is true, but that there was an individual, I think it was a male, stayed awake for approximately 11 days in a row with little or no side effects after the fact, didn't have to have extended sleep. Have you heard of that? I mean, what's the craziest condition you've seen in your work?
The patients that have the most difficult time is severe anxiety. Although some patients, whenever they have depression, will actually have very poor sleep for days in a row. Now, typically, the patient will underestimate how much they sleep. They will actually be in bed and will tell us that maybe they only slept 3 or 4 hours. In reality, if we were monitoring, they would have been sleeping more. But yeah, as you referred to, there's several individuals over the last 20 to 30 years that have done these sustained awake episodes, and they can actually stay awake for 10, 12, even some, I think, up to 14 days with very little sleep. How they're able to do it and the rest of us can't, I can't answer that.
Okay. Hey, Doctor. Go ahead. Go ahead, sir.
I was just going to say, as Dr. Stevens said, though, I would be suspicious, one, that perhaps they're not perceiving times of sleep that they're actually getting, and two, if it is truly severe, I begin to think about perhaps underlying significant psychiatric disorders such as bipolar disorder. So you have to kind of keep that in mind as well, I think.
We received another email, and it's asking, what about when you have an infant? How do you condition that infant to fall asleep? Is that even possible? And then how do you manage your own sleep deficit at the same time? Do you want to take a stab at that, Dr. Stevens?
That can actually even be more difficult because now you're not only trying to control your own sleep and habits and behavior and sleep quality, you have an individual now. And unfortunately, there's just not a lot of research in newborns and sleep, very little actually. And there's lots of different schools of thought, everything from letting the baby, you know, quote, cry it out to actually, co-sleep with the child. And it's really all over the place as far as recommendations and how to handle that scenario. Is the main thing as far as the parents, you are probably going to have to sleep when you can sleep. There's just not really another way around it typically, or at least share those responsibilities with a spouse, a partner, so at least, you know, between the two of you, you can get adequate sleep if that's a possibility.
Mm-hmm. We're running close to our break time, but I want to ask you, I know a lot of this, the sleep difficulties are the result of lifestyle, but genetics can play a factor too. And Dr. Stevens, why don't you first address that, and then Dr. Eveloff, I'm going to ask you the same question.
Yeah, it's interesting because it turns out that essentially every sleep disorder has some degree of genetic component. Now, some of them are quite strong. You mentioned the parasomnia behavior, the sleepwalking, sleep talking. That's pretty strongly genetic. You almost always will find some other individual, a sibling, a parent that was also a sleepwalker, sleep talker. Narcolepsy, the one you referred to before, is not as strongly genetic, but there is some populations that it's described also. Sleep apnea to some degree is genetic. Insomnia, we don't know enough about it to study the genes, but when you start asking family history, quite often you also get the story that either mother, father, brother, sister, or several other siblings had bad sleep in the family.
Dr. Eveloff.
Yeah, I think Dr. Stevens summarized it excellently. There's sort of a hierarchy of genetic predisposition depending on the exact sleep disorder. As he said, the parasomnia, sleepwalking, bedwetting, those have a rather strong genetic predisposition. I also think that there is some genetic predisposition to sleep apnea, although not as strong. And then insomnia, as he referred to, I just don't think there's as much known about that. There probably is some genetic component as well to almost every sleep disorder, however.
Dr. Scott Eveloff is a sleep physician at American Sleep Medicine. He joins us by phone this morning. Thanks for being with us today.
Sure. Thank you very much.
And Dr. Damian Stevens is the director of the Sleep Disorder Center at KU Medical Center. Nice to talk to you, sir.
Thank you for inviting me.
Yeah, have a pleasant day and a good night of sleep.
Yes.
Yeah. Let me ask you this before you do leave. Do you sleep well?
I do for now.
This is Central Standard on KCUR. I'm Bill Anderson. Just ahead, dreams. A random sequence of unimportant brain activities or a brain function we can and should learn from? This in a segment about what Kansas City is saying about last year's tragedy at JJ's restaurant. You're listening to Central Standard on KCUR. And welcome back. I'm Bill Anderson. Interpretations of dreams date to the BC time period. Some civilizations viewed dreams as doorways into other realities, perhaps into future realities, while others, the Romans as an example, viewed dreams in a religious context. Dreams were even viewed as temptations from the devil. Ancient Chinese civilizations believed the soul left to a different physical space. Colleagues at KCUR talk of having nightmarish dreams that are tied to disaster happening on live radio in the studios, microphones not working, not being able to get into the studio as the program ends, not being able to talk coherently. Well, that would be me in real life. But what about your dreams? Call us, 816-235-2888. Email the show, centralstandard@kcur.org. Now joining us in the studio, psychologist Dr. Bruce Manley. Good morning.
Good morning.
And we're going to be talking about dreams in this next segment. So, you know, we talked earlier in the program about the four stages of sleep, REM being the deepest form. But dreams happen in all four stages. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Well, now, I'm not so much an expert about the stages of sleep and, you know, the state, the actual time that the dream happens.
Uh-huh.
I'm not for sure. I thought the doctors that were on before said something about, you know, dream and REM sleep is where it's at.
Yeah.
And that the other four stages tend not to be associated with dreaming.
And I apologize for I was a little out of bounds there and put you on the spot with that
question. Oh,
that's
okay. That's okay.
Well, let's talk a little bit about dreams because, you know, there's everyone dreams. Some of us have better recall than others.
Oh, yes.
And let's start at that point. Why? Why do I not remember my dreams and you recall yours with great clarity?
Well, I'm not so good at remembering mine either.
Okay.
And some people do remember them with remarkable clarity, and some don't. And I don't have a good answer what the difference is there. I've got some vague theories about it that would get into some Freudian ideas,
uh-huh.
But having to do with repression and that sort of thing.
Yeah, well why not talk about it?
Especially maybe one of the reasons we don't remember dreams is because they're too anxious, and so we put it away.
Well, I've noticed that. Dreams generally are almost always are emotionally charged.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I mean, there might be some dreams out there that aren't so emotional, but it seems to me like most of them involve, like during your intro, you mentioned something about anxiety about the mics not working.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
I mean, it would be hard for me to imagine anybody's never had a dream about something that they're anxious about.
Right. Yeah. You know,
and so if we're anxious, then, you know, if the anxiety is too much, we tend to not want to think about it.
Okay, so you're clicking now on exactly what Sigmund Freud stood for. I mean, he believed that we were doing while we were essentially unconscious,
mm-hmm.
we were doing what we were afraid to do or unwilling to do during our waking hours.
Something along that line.
Yes.
Yeah. The way I think about it is just a little bit different, that takes a little bit broader view.
Well, you're the expert, so go ahead, sir.
Well, it's something I've thought about a lot.
Yeah.
I tend to see dreams as some kind of problem solving by the unconscious mind.
Okay.
That gets into consciousness. Now, that's a little different than Freud's view, but it also includes a lot of dreams that maybe didn't fit into Freud's theory quite so well, like people, I know myself, when I was a kid and learning how to play, learning how to use the typewriter, I had dreams of the keyboard, learning where the keys were,
uh-huh.
and learning how to touch type as a teenager. And now, you know, it just seems perfectly natural thing to do. But at that time, you know, I was really trying to learn how to type.
Uh-huh.
And I recall having a few dreams about that. It was long, long ago.
And Freud, obviously, he spent a lot of time, a lot of focus on sexual repression, or believe
right.
that
right.
in many cases dreams were connected to and this was the Victorian time period, a repressive state of our sexual desires. What are your thoughts on that in 2014? Do you dismiss that? Do you buy into that?
I don't dismiss it.
Uh-huh.
But a lot of us nowadays think that Freud's emphasis upon sex was just too much of an emphasis. And though it's very, very important for a particular person, you know, in general, the things that we repress have to do with anxiety, and that will have as much to do about whether one is loved or unloved, whether one is doing well in life, as it does about something sexual.
Mm-hmm.
A whole nother way to look at it is that Freud may have been using sex more as a metaphor rather than as an explicit physiological event.
Psychologist Dr. Bruce Manley is here on KCUR talking about dreams. I'm Bill Anderson. We can probably squeeze in a couple of calls if you want to phone 235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. We have gotten an email from Brooke, and she asked, Doctor, I have for my entire life always remembered my dreams in very vivid detail every day. Nothing I do makes any difference in the dreaming, and it causes me to feel worn out, tired, and emotionally stressed, having to cope with the dream memories every single day, even though I do enjoy some of my dreams. Any thoughts or suggestions for Brooke?
Well, that she's a vivid dreamer.
Mm-hmm.
I kind of envy her for that, and that she remembers them.
Yeah.
Because I have the vivid dreams, but I don't remember them so well. That she's bothered by them. You know, that there's no easy solution for that. Was there something about recurring dreams there, or do they tend to be a variety?
It doesn't really indicate.
Okay.
I got the impression that they were of a variety.
A variety. And some of them are good, and she's troubled by others.
Right.
See, I really don't know what to say to her. Some of us see our dreams as a resource, as something to help us live life better, as a tool to use, maybe in psychotherapy is the way I use it. But she's bothered by them, and I'm not sure, you know, what that's all about for her.
Obviously, you put an emphasis on dreams. You factor in their relevance to our waking hours.
Absolutely.
So how important are dreams?
Well, I think they are important, and I think that we're doing things in our dreams, whether we're aware of them or not, and that they're actually part of the way that our psyche develops.
Okay. Go ahead.
Go ahead.
Well, I was going to say whether we're aware of it or not.
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly. You know, I wish I remembered my dreams better, but I still think that they're serving me even without understanding them. There's
mm-hmm.
a whole lot that goes on in our unconscious minds that we're not aware of, but which is very much a part of who we are.
Mm-hmm.
We do all kinds of things without thinking about them, and we learn how to do all kinds of things without, you know, a little bit of practice, and then it becomes automatic, like driving a car.
Well, Mark is calling from Kansas City, Missouri, and he joins us in the air. Hi, Mark.
Good morning.
Go ahead.
I suppose this is a continuation of Brooke's email. I was speaking to your producer, my question is, how unique is it that I dream not only in color, but also when I awake, not only can I remember the dream, but mirroring what Brooke wrote, I can remember entire conversations, not just snippets, but the back and forth as if I was actually speaking to that person awake. You know, 30 seconds ago, I can remember entire paragraphs of conversations. And then also, it's not uncommon that if I do wake up in the middle of the night and I remember a dream and I fall back asleep, even if I go to get a drink of water, sometimes I'll fall back into the same dream as if I was watching a DVD or something. I'm positive. I'm not exactly the same at that moment, but it's the same format, the same whatever I was dreaming.
Mark, I'm going to have to put you on hold there and get an answer for you because we're having a little bit of a tough time hearing your remarks. Doctor, can you reply to Mark? Give him your evaluation, so to speak?
Well, just as I was saying about the former caller, that he can remember his dreams so well, I see as an asset. Now, the problem is he may not experience it as an asset.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure I'm biased, but I think this is the kind of thing that you want to be talking with somebody about.
Okay.
You know, if something's bothering you, get somebody to talk to. You know, it could be a professional. It could be a significant other.
A confidant.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Because carrying these things around inside of oneself, I think that's the problem.
Shannon has a problem with dreams, and it's one of the more common. Shannon, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. I've been having dreams kind of throughout all of my youth about my teeth breaking, shattering, falling, and breaking them. Just want to get some thoughts on that.
Wow, that's a rich one. Here we start to get into the issue of symbolism. You know, we could think about your teeth breaking literally, or we could think about it as a symbol for something else. And that's the kind of thing that takes some thought and discussion and some real care to not apply cookbook ideas to what does it mean that one's teeth is breaking. You know, to dig into that personally, you know, in a discussion with a confidant or a professional, and to journal about it perhaps and to think about, you know, what is teeth breaking? You know, what does that mean for you? What else comes to mind? What other kind of experiences in life does that relate to for you?
235-2888, 816-235-2888. And calling from Fairway is Bob. Hi, Bob. You're on the air.
Oh, hi. Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
You know, I was going to say that I've been with my girlfriend for about 10 years, and we always sleep together. And when we wake up, I would say, you know, at least 25 to 50% of the time, we remember our dreams and we tell each other what we dreamed. And whether we understand them or not, because I think you're right, we know what the dream was. They're very vivid. At least mine are, and hers really are always detailed. But if we're connecting with the unconscious, then maybe your partner will, their unconscious will then hear at least what your dream was and kind of recognize unconsciously whatever it was. And so I think that becomes a part of the dream and a part of your relationship.
Doctor?
I agree. Yeah. It sounds like a rich experience you're sharing with her.
Sue is calling from somewhere in Kansas City. Sue, you're on the air. Good morning. Well, we've lost Sue here, but Sue was talking about some of her dreams are stressful, but she said most are kind of fun. In fact, she has in parentheses flying as an example of the fun she has.
Yes.
Any thoughts about what that could possibly mean?
Oh, yes, flying dreams. They're well known to students of dreams.
Uh-huh.
And they are fun. They are fun. And again, they have some sort of symbolic meaning. And to get into a cookbook interpretation of what that meaning is would be an error. You know, what do the flying dreams mean to her? You know, I'd be curious.
Yeah.
You know, they're fun. What else is fun, you know?
Let me ask you this. With what's happening with technology and the way it's evolving and how quickly it's evolving, is the study of dreams, is it advancing along with technology? And do we know more now than we, say, knew 10, 15 years ago?
There's been some stuff where they've done the MRIs on people while they're dreaming, and I'm not an expert in this area.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're starting to link together, you know, where is the dreaming going on in the brain? And there's just some fascinating stuff that's been going on in the past 15 to 20 years. It's just in its infancy.
Now, I know Sigmund Freud gets credit for bringing dream research back into vogue in the late 19th century, but it was Mary Whiten Calkins who was really the person who initiated extensive kind of the quantitative studies of dreams back in the 1800s, the late 1800s, I believe, and actually started kind of creating codes to demonstrate, you know, that many people shared realistic settings in their dreams. They were always highly emotional, oftentimes negative in emotion. You want to talk about that a little bit?
You've got me as far as awareness of her work, but the idea of codifying things like this, I'm not aware of anything that's been done in the last 30 or 40 years, but there could be people out there that are doing that. And I think it's worth doing. Not everyone would agree with me on that.
Let's talk to Steve in North Kansas City.
Hi, Bill. Thanks for taking my call.
Thank you, sir.
I'd like to ask the experts about something. I've read about this for a while, and I've asked a couple folks, and I haven't gotten a consensus, so I'd like your opinion on this. Since the advent of electric lights, people spend a lot less time in the dark than they used to. Most folks, you know, used to sleep in the morning and, you know, when the sun went down and wake up when it came up. And previously, we would spend between probably 10 to maybe 14 hours a day in the dark. And I wondered if that had something to do with how that influenced our sleep patterns now versus when years ago when people were living as hunter-gatherers, and some people had to spend part of the night, you know, had to spend part of the time, you know, watching the camp and guarding against intruders and things like that, and how that longer period in the dark versus what we're doing now has affected our life today.
Yeah, good call, Steve. Doctor?
Good question, and one that I think about myself, and I don't have a good answer to it. I think there's got to be changes with the way our sleep cycles have been changed by electricity and electronic media, that sort of thing.
In short, what do you make of the criticism that the study of dreams receives from some who completely dismiss it? They say we either don't know enough about it, we don't understand the brain well enough to even make some conclusions, or that it's just irrelevant.
Yeah, and I think there'll always be people that say that it's irrelevant, that it's meaningless. And, in the long run, whatever that means, it could turn out that they'd be right. But getting hard empirical research for it is in progress. I'll probably never see it in my lifetime. And
I think you will.
Well, we're seeing a little bit.
Yeah.
And probably you're touching on a bigger topic than I can get into right now. A lot of what dreaming is about is not so much the objective part of the dream, but what does it mean to the dreamer? And that's always going to be an issue for human beings.
Well, Dr. Bruce Manley, we're out of time for this segment. Dr. Bruce Manley is a psychologist in Kansas City, and we appreciate you coming into the studios this morning.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
Yeah, have a great day, sir.
Thank you.